this time. Ditko ladies, the Trailblazers so far ahead of their time that only a change of the rules could beat them. Hello and welcome to By Far the Greatest Team, a podcast in which football fans attempt to rank the greatest teams ever. My name's Graham Dunn, and as ever over in football's equivalent of Dictionary Corner, it's Jamie Rooney. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, Graham. Dictionary's Corner, that's pretty good. That's the first time I think I've ever been referred to as a dictionary. But just to back it up, I'm feeling pretty gladsome and chirpy right now, I have to say. I'm really looking forward to this one. I had a brilliant weekend in Copenhagen. I was lucky enough to go and see the Copenhagen derby, Brøndby versus Copenhagen, and it was incredibly fierce and incredibly excited. But I have to say, for that excitement, I think it's going to be topped with what we're about to learn about in this particular episode.
Yeah, absolutely. This week, we've got our first women's team on the pod, but the first of many, we hope. And when we stopped to think about where to begin, we realised there really is only one place to begin. The pioneers of the women's game, Preston's Ditko Ladies. And we've done a few historical teams on the pod before, and we're usually pretty heavily reliant on Wikipedia when it comes to that. However, this time we're lucky enough to have the person who Wikipedia is probably heavily reliant on when it comes to Ditko Ladies. It's the author of In a League of Their Own. It's Gail Newsham. Hiya, Gail.
Hi, Graham. Hi, Jamie.
Good to have you on board. We're really looking forward to this. But before we get on to the story itself, and it is, anyone who's not familiar with this story, it is an absolutely incredible story. Parts of it, absolutely mind-blowing. But as people can probably detect from your accent, you are from Preston, and this is a story which isn't just close to your heart, but it's sort of physically close to you as well, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, I walk the same streets that they walked. You know, I grew up near the factory, and when I'm ever down that side of town now and I'm walking around, I'll just think to myself, Alice Kell walked down here. And they're just with me all the time, and it's great, you know, I was so close to it, little realising it when I was a kid. But, yeah, I think it's just one of those things that we're meant to be.
And as a kid, I mean, did you know anything about this story? Or when did you first become aware of Ditko Ladies?
From a very early age, I knew there was a ladies' football team in Preston. I was always out playing football with lads. I was on the park. I was the only girl kicking a ball about with lads. And I can remember, as I say, I was only very, very young, but somebody walking by and saying, oh, she's good, she should be playing for Ditko Ladies. And that was, I think, my first awareness, really, that there was a women's team in Preston. My dad did talk about them as well. My dad saw them play in the 30s. He knew where Mr. Franklin's fruit shop was in Preston and all that. So he had seen him about the place. So that there was just some, you know, little, even though it was a distant connection, there was just something there.
I mean, it is an incredible story, but also relatively hidden from the world before you started to shine a light on it. I mean, it's not a story I was particularly familiar with. Jamie, had you come across it before?
As much as football's been a cornerstone of my life, and I'm quite fascinated by the history of the game, until the internet, as it was back in 2007-08, was able to shine a light on this. And clearly, at this point, Gail had already written a book on this particular brilliant team long before the internet was even really a thing. That was my introduction to it. Yeah, I found it quite a fascinating story from its conception right through to the tours that they went on, right through to the kind of more troubling times that we're probably going to touch on towards the end of this episode. But yeah, I was quite fascinated. And it's one of the key reasons why we wanted to do this podcast, because we want to be able to talk about these football teams. And to have Gail with us today is an absolute pleasure and a privilege.
So, Ditko Ladies, I mean, who are they? Where did they come from?
They were formed during the First World War from a munitions factory in Preston, which was Ditko and Company Limited. There wasn't a guy called Ditko It was the founders of the company were William, Bruce Dick and John Kerr from Scotland. So that's why there's a comma after just two people, like Smith and Jones, if you will. And they were formed in 1917 to raise funds for wounded soldiers at the local Moor Park Military Hospital. And they played the first game at Preston North End at Deepdale on Christmas Day 1917. And 10,000 people came to watch them. And they raised £600 for the wounded soldiers, which would be worth almost £50,000 today. So they had a pretty good start, and they just went from strength to strength after that.
That is absolutely mad that for your, for the first game, you get 10,000 people. I mean, the team I follow... that's a very good day. We roll out the ticker tape when we get to 10,000.
Yeah, it was phenomenal, really, that many people. I mean, I'm sure there was the novelty aspect, of course, women playing football and the patriotic nature as well. You know, we're in the depths of war and people pulled together at those kind of times. So there would have been all of that, raising money for these lads who were, you know, they'd been fighting at the front and they were being treated and recovering from their injuries, you know, in the hospital. So there would have been many factors to get that amount of people there in the first instance. And you think, oh, well, yeah, there's the novelty thing. But then they grew and grew and grew after that. And it was just really quite a phenomenal story. If it wasn't true, I wouldn't believe it myself.
Gail, a question for you. In the early days, we generally try to do a lot of good research coming into these things, and we realise we're going to be marked quite severely on the things that we kind of put into the pod by yourself. I'm going to be careful. I've double-checked my homework. So one of the things I read was there was a player in the early days, Alice Norris, and she challenged the boys in the factory playground when they were playing football during the lunchtime. You know, to see who could kick the ball through the window. And if the boys won, they got some Woodbines. If the girls won, they got a fries chocolate bar or Five Boys chocolate bar, that classic kind of design. Is that a true story? Is that something that really happened?
That is a true story. Alice Norris told me that story. So everything I tell you comes from them. It wasn't Alice that got the girls together to play against the lads. That was Grace Sibbert. And Alice came along after that. I think Alice started working for the company in around about 1920. It was Alice that told me that story about them kicking the ball and breaking the windows. So, yeah. So, as I said, everything I tell you is from them.
Oh, that's fantastic. How unusual was it for women to be playing football at that time?
Well, but really, because during the war, women's football was like, it was the game that most of the munition girls, you know, played. Nearly every factory across the country had a women's football team. And it was all for the, you know, fundraising for the soldiers, for the war effort and all that kind of thing. So there were lots and lots of teams, you know, across the country, but there weren't quite many as good as the Dick Kerr ladies.
And it's particularly interesting given what happens to them from the authorities, you know, later on. This was something that was essentially promoted and supported by the authorities, by the government, by the company as well, I guess.
There was a lot of support for them, you know, the management at the company. Winston Churchill gave permission for searchlights to be used at the ground for a night match in 1920. You know, there was a great deal of support for them, you know, across the board. And, of course, there was the other side of the coin where people still thought that women shouldn't be playing football. But I think, you know, the patriotism and all that and the fact that they were a very skillful team, that raised the profile, you know, quite tremendously.
And that first game in the factory yard, so nobody knows the score of this, is that right?
It's one of those, because the lady that told it to me was the daughter of the lady that started it, and she was always proud of her involvement with the team at that time. And they let her keep the football, and it was Edna Sibbert, who was Grace's daughter, who told me the story, and she actually gave me the picture, the first ever picture of the team. And Gracie sat with the ball on her lap, you know, because she'd got it going. They said that she could keep the match ball. But whenever I said, well, how did they get on? What was the score? No. And nobody seems to know. So I think I wouldn't like to hazard a guess. I really don't know.
It was obviously a creditable enough performance that they thought they could form a team out of this and do it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they played with the lads every day in the factory yard, and they'd had a bad run of results. and they've lost quite a few of the games. So the girls are giving them a bit of stick, like you do. You know, you call yourselves a football team, we can do better than you. So that's their share. Well, prove it then. You know, so they had this challenge match, and I'm sure they had a lot of fun. I'm sure it was a great afternoon, or you know, whatever when they played. I'm sure they had a great deal of fun.
When the team was set up, there seems to be quite a lot of references to Alfred Franklin being like a core part of giving the ladies the platform and supporting and organising. How important was Alfred Franklin?
Very important. He was a great, he was the mentor and manager, and he had a great marketing skill, organisational skills. And, you know, it has to be said that without him, they wouldn't have done what they did or carried on as long, because he was with them until his death in 1957. So he was very, very important.
As we see in the Premiership these days, managers don't stay in post that long.
there was nobody to sack him, was there, back then?
The bit I was really curious about was whether, was football part of his life beforehand, or was he just, he presumably was employed by Dick Kerr, the factory.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an unusual sideline for him to end up.
Yeah, no, I don't think he had much of a sports background. I just think he saw a potential waiting to be nurtured. Mm. And he took that opportunity, and everybody gained from it. Girls got to do things that they would never have been able to do otherwise, you know, travel. I mean, back in those days, a day trip to Blackpool, you know, was a luxury for people in Lancashire. And they got to travel all over the country and beyond.
And it is quite incredible that first game is played at Deepdale. I suppose that shows just how, or how much interest there was in them right from the outset.
Well, the league football programme had been cancelled, you know, because of the war. So Deepdale was sat empty, really. It was beneficial for Preston North End to have a match there, and I don't know, selling refreshments. They'd have made a few, Bob. It was a beneficial for, you know, for everybody all round, really. But following on from the first game, the Dick Kerr ladies played all the home games at Preston North End throughout 1918-19 and lots in 1920. You know, some of the iconic games were played at Preston North End. So there's a huge history at Preston North End, you know, with the Dick Kerr ladies.
Now, we're always interested in kits on this podcast. We love the kits. Can you describe the Dick Kerr ladies' club colours?
Yes, well, they played in black and white striped shirts, sky blue shorts, black and white socks, and of course there was the hats.
The hats. So that was part of the initial requirement for the women to play in their hats. Is that right?
Yeah, in those days, most women had long hair, so they had to tie them. Put the hair up into the hats, because they weren't allowed to wear hair grips or hair pins when they were playing. That was the way to keep your hair from flowing all over the place.
I mean, the photos are brilliant to look at, actually, that as a result. The early ones were the Preston full kit and the hats as well. It's just brilliant.
Yeah, they didn't really enjoy wearing the hats. It was just a necessary evil.
Well, I was going to say, on the face of it, it does feel like it isn't going to help. It's not... Yeah. It's not something that they kind of took off.
No.
So from that initial start, they then start playing more regularly. What sorts of teams were they playing?
Well, the other munitions factories initially, but predominantly. But then, you know, as women's football became more of a spectator sport, if you will, more teams were springing up. But predominantly in the early years, they were all pretty much, you know, from munitions works and, you know, places like that.
They was pretty successful from the start, and then they kind of, I guess maybe because they're doing well, they're able to start attracting players to the team as well, aren't they?
Well, yeah. I mean, they took it very seriously. You know, midweek they were training at Preston North End, you know, the ground where they were using for training. And they were fortunate. Some of the North End players actually worked at the Dick Kerr factory, so that they got coaching from them. You know, Bob Hope was one of the original Invincibles, and several other lads that, you know, they were there helping out. So everybody was, you know, focused on being a good football side. And they worked hard. They were working full time and playing football at the weekend. So yeah, it was beneficial all round.
Gail, just on the Bob Holmes reference, and you've referenced it already, where Winston Churchill was commissioned these anti-aircraft spotlights for the game. I think it was on Pape News website where they call it soccer by searchlight. And is it true that Bob Holmes, he had a particular responsibility and job that day to make sure that the ball, which would traditionally be a brown leather ball, wasn't brown and was easy for the players, the ladies to see on the field of play?
Yeah, see, he came up with the idea of whitewashing the brown football, and that was his job during the course of the game. He was on the touchline whitewashing the footballs and throwing them on at regular intervals so that everybody could see a white ball from all parts of the arena. So it might have well been the first white football ever, you know.
We have to unpick this evening game, which was presumably a first and just the most extraordinary idea to play a game, an evening game, I don't know, about 50 years before floodlights existed. Yeah. I mean, how did they make it work?
Well, they got the floodlights, of course. You know, they had a meeting. It was all to raise money for the ex-servicemen in the town who were, you know, falling on hard times, obviously, and they came up with this novel idea. Some of the prominent politicians, councillors of the time were very supportive, and it was there, you know, they all came up with this idea of playing a match at night and getting the searchlights, and they approached the War Office to loan these lights, and there was carbide flares all around the outside of the ground as well. But there were, you know, the lights kept going out due to petrol shortage and airlocks and all of that kind of stuff. So there were lots of amusing incidents. One of the players, Jenny Harris, who was the smallest player on the team, at one point, nobody could find her in the darkness until a camera on the light. And then there's Jenny, you know, she's found. And so it was a really novel night. And again, there was another 10,000 people came to watch that. If you've seen the footage on the Pathé, you can see the crowd.
The Pathé footage is fantastic. But just on Jenny Harris, you mentioned her size. She was a bit tricky as well. She had that kind of classic low centre of gravity. He was that type of player who could do a few tricks and outpace her opponent just by quick speed of turn.
Yeah, she was a naturally gifted player. Was Jenny? She was only 4'10", so that you know appreciates the layer of gravity. But everybody loved her. Players, the fans loved her. When they played the French team at Deepdale for the first time, Jenny scored one of the goals. And the crowd loved her, and they came onto the pitch at the end and carried her shoulder high. And her relationship with Flo Redford up front, you know, them two scoring goals together, they were telepathic, really. And you couldn't afford to buy them today. They just knew they had a great partnership up front, and they were called the Dick Kerr's box of tricks because they were always scoring goals.
You reference the French games there, and I think the incredible thing about this story is how they kind of really innovated across so many ways, not just using searchlights for nighttime games, but which kind of French team came over? Was it a national French team or a club side from France?
They were a representative team made up of several players, clubs out there from Paris. They'd approached the Dick Kerr team to come to England to play an international match, and they, you know, took up the challenge. And they arranged a tour and they played four games, but the first game played at Preston North End, and 25,000 spectators came to that match, and that was a record crowd for the ground at that time. There'd never been a bigger crowd at Deepdale before then. During that tour, they played the four games and they raised over £3,000 for the wounded soldiers. So, we're looking at a lot of money. They were doing a lot of good with all of this. But, following on from that, the French team came up pretty much every year. They came over and went on tour up to the Second World War and beyond.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, it was quite a good relationship that they all had with them.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And is it Carmen Pommies? Had
I think it's Pommier is the correct pronunciation.
Yeah, that sounds better.
that's how it reads, isn't it?
Pommies, yeah. Pommiers does sound, it does have a bit more of a Parisian lilt. Is this right that she was in the original French team that came over and then ultimately ends up playing for Dick Kerr ladies?
Yeah. She had a long affiliation with the team at Carmen, and she's another one that everybody loved as well, saying what a wonderful lady she was. And when I'm down that side of town again, I think Carmen walked down here, you know, because she was just lived within walking distance of the factory. But she was a really good player, champion javelin thrower in France. she turned her hand to more sports. She was a really good tennis player as well. She eventually went to live in America later on after the Second World War. But during the Second World War, she was a heroine on the barricades in the resistance. Her story is absolutely fantastic. You must read the new edition of my book because there's a chapter dedicated to Carmen in that. What an amazing woman, honestly. And she lived and worked in Preston.
Oh, well, I'm not gonna ask why wouldn't someone swap Paris for Preston?
Well, they were the best women's football team, weren't they? You know, I mean, she'd had that experience of playing against them, and she, you know, she came over for a couple of years. She went to America with them, so she, you know, she got a good deal out of that. And practically every year after that, up to the Second World War, she came back with the team. And they went on tour playing football, raising money for charity. And then the last time I think she came was just after the war. She came to explore the opportunity of teams coming over again. Shortly after that, that was the last time I think she ever came to Preston because she got a job opportunity in Rochester, New York. She went to work there for the United Nations eventually. But she was a fantastic tennis player. While she was out there, won lots of awards, but eventually she went back to France, and she died on her 82nd birthday. If there's somebody you'd want to have round for a brew and have a chat with, you know, I really would love to have met her. She captivates you, really. She's a fantastic lady.
If having Carmen round is the best thing for a cup of tea, I think unfortunately she's not here, but we definitely have the next best thing because we're getting these kind of secondhand accounts that, you know, feel that we're having that cup of tea with her right now, which is great.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice.
I mean, this is one of the great things because they're all amateurs. They have this kind of extraordinary football existence, but the players all go on and, you know, they all have these other extraordinary parts of their life. Whereas, you know, actually when you're looking at players in the professional game, they kind of play football, maybe go and do some coaching or manage, you know, this whole, you know, it is an extraordinary thing. Now, they think I play four games against France when they come over in the first time. Do they come out on top across the four games?
They lost the last one at Chelsea. They lost 2-1. I struggled to find a lot of information about that one. I know that somebody scored an own goal. There was an inadvertent thing. Goalkeeper, and the only other players, Jenny had been knocked out. She was unconscious, so she couldn't play. So they were down to 10 players, but they lost the last match. But when they went out to France later in the year, they came home unbeaten. They didn't win. I think they drew one of the games, but they won the others, and so they did quite well.
So they retained bragging rights.
Absolutely. They got a rapturous welcome when they came home. You know, the streets were lined with thousands of people all along the route back to the Ditko factory. You know, they were being cheered, you know, all through the town. I imagine it would be an incredible sight.
And now, I guess probably the most famous game or possibly the high point of that, it has to be the Boxing Day game against St. Helens Ladies at Goodison Park, which the number of people... who went to that game, it is mind-blowing. I mean, was it more special than others? Was there a reason why, other than it maybe being on it was Boxing Day, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was Boxing Day. They were going to play it at Tranmere Rovers, but they couldn't be played there for whatever reason, and Goodison sort of like stepped in, I think, at the last minute. It was a game for the wounded soldiers. They promised to go out and raise money for soldiers on Merseyside. What makes that game even more incredible, the 53,000 turn up to watch them? We're on Merseyside, right? So the day before, Everton had played at home. The afternoon of the Goodison match, Liverpool were playing at home. So you've got the two Merseyside clubs playing at home within a couple of days, and yet 53,000 still come to watch women's football. Well, probably more if they could have fit them in because they had to turn, you know, 10,000 or more away. So that, you know, that when you look at it in that context as well, you know, the big Merseyside clubs, I think one had played Arsenal and the other had played Chelsea. I can't remember which way around it was. Crowds for them. But, yeah, 53,000 still came to watch the Ditko ladies play St. Helens. So I think it was a defining moment for women's football as well. I think that was probably the start of what was to come.
It really is significant. I mean, it's a massive moment. And just to kind of help flavour the context, the 53,000, you've alluded to the Everton capacity and the Liverpool v Chelsea capacity, which are 50,000 the day after, I think, or the same day. But Everton, as an average for that season, were drawing around about 35,000. That game is, you know, is 20,000 more than what Everton would normally command for a game. And just to kind of give it another context, England played Scotland in the April of that year, 1920, at Hillsborough, and that was 40,000. Just to kind of give the context in terms of how incredibly popular this fixture was.
They also had a kind of a celebrity kicking off the match as well, in a sort of almost Diana Ross at the World Cup kind of moment, only slightly better, I think.
Well, yeah, Ella Retford, I think, kicked off that day. She was a pantomime principal boy, and she was the lady that wrote She's a Lassie from Lancashire. So she was really quite a big star. But they did have big names, you know, throughout the history. They always had big names kicking off at the game. I mean, Dixie Dean kicked off for them at Liverpool.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, George Formby kicked off after just leading up to the Second World War. There were lots and lots of big names. Gracie Fields was another. It happened a lot. It really, really did.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant. The other thing I read about this, and again, this is where we're able to fact check any of these things. So we mentioned earlier the Florrie Redford, the striker. Now, did I read correctly that she missed her train and couldn't play the game?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, she did. It must have been absolutely devastating for her, really, when you look back and think, bloody hell, you know, biggest game ever, and she wasn't there. But there, see, that game, they played Jenny Harris at centre-forward, and she scored a goal, and they were 1-0 up at half-time. But Captain Alice Kell, she got a bit of an injury, so they put her up front second half just to keep her, you know, keep her safe. She scores a hat-trick. And they went 4-0, you know. So it was a good day all round, even without Flo playing, you know, the best striker.
There's nothing more depressing for a forward when a defender goes up top and gets two or three, gets a hat trick. I mean, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've from a personal point of view, I've experienced this year. Graham and I, we play in a senior football team. We went for a tour in Workington. I'm a forward. I got injured. Our centre back went up front, and he scored three goals and never stops talking about it.
Actually, you take it a bit for granted, the, you know, even travelling to games. But I mean, that was that's a huge logistical thing. Let alone for amateurs to be able to do this, and you've got other things going on in your life. Even the commitment to play, it must have been huge for them.
Absolutely huge, you know. I mean, but they loved it. Alice Kell's father, he was a ticket inspector or something on the railways. So when they were leaving from Preston by train, he always made sure that they had, you know, a good carriage and looked after them that way. But they travelled through, you know, by coach as well, and obviously they were a bit bone shakers in those days, weren't they? But I'm sure they had a great time, and they were just having the time of their lives, really.
And the team was fairly young, wasn't it? I think in terms of the average age, they were young ladies, which kind of makes sense that they are having the time of their life. So does that mean the responsibilities at that time for them were fairly light, so they could combine the kind of the family, the work, and the football life, or was it just the priority was football and everything else came secondary?
No, they were like a family, you know. I remember Alice Norris telling me about Alice Kell and Flo Redford looking after her because she was one of the younger players, and they made sure that she was all right. They went to a match one time, and this bloke were giving Alice a bit of unwanted attention, shall we say. And Flo Redford went over and told him to, you know, to do one, mate, basically, you know. And he said, "What's it got to do with you? She's my kid's sister. That's what it's got to do with me. Now sling your up, you know, that type of thing." So they did look after one another. And Alice told me another tale about she'd gone round to Alice Kell's house, and her brother was bit interested in it. And she was saying, now leave her alone, she's only young. And Alice says, like, what do you mean I'm 19 now? So they were just kids, you know, but they looked after one another. They were a great unit. There was a lot of team spirit and camaraderie. Yeah. Nobody had a bad word to say, really, about any arguments in the team or jealousies or anything. You know, they were all, I think, just enjoying the situation that they were in.
And I guess as well, I mean, and Jamie, you were talking about this, that actually the attention on the team had sort of outgrown Preston itself, hadn't it? I mean, especially with the attention it was getting through the Pate newsreels.
Definitely. There's a quote in 1924 at the company annual general meeting that the ladies' football team was now more famous than the company. I mean, the company... The company exported tram cars all over the world. So the Nick Curl ladies were there, thought, you know, more famous than them.
Is it true, Gail, that the Pate News features started around about 1920 and then just continued all the time through then, which is obviously going to grow the popularity? I think cinema viewing at that particular point in the UK was, you know, somewhere around about 40, 50 million people were watching films a year. You know, people going to the cinema more than once or twice a week. So did that really kind of propel the team into another space in terms of where they were? Or were they already on that journey naturally and Pate just kind of helped supplement it?
I think they were already on that journey naturally, but it did help. I remember another lady talking to me, Eva Gardner, she was telling me that they had been filming one of their games and it was on, you know, the Pate News at the cinema. And this friend came running up to her and said, I saw you when you were on this, you know, in the pictures. And so, you know, it was they were like celebrities and it was a thrilling thing for them to be, you know, to be on the picture screen. I mean, for heaven's sake, you can't imagine what it must have felt like.
As you say, the game itself is probably a turning point for what comes. But actually, 1921, phenomenal year in terms of the games they play. I mean, they get through a lot of fixtures, don't they?
No, they played 67 games of football in 1921 and almost 900,000 people came to watch them. So, I mean, it just blows your mind, doesn't it, think about all those people coming to watch women's football. And, yeah, they don't forget, they're still working full-time at the factory as well, travelling up and down the country, and they didn't have a chartered plane or a private, you know, bus or whatever, you know, they had to get there by any means that they could. So they all did really, really well. And in 1921, Flo Redford scored 170 goals. You know, so they had a pretty successful year.
What are people going on about Haaland right now? I mean, he's, what, 50 goals? That's nothing compared to 170 goals.
Exactly. And she deserves to be in the record books for that, doesn't she? You know, no matter what level of the game you're at, to score 170 goals in 1 year, working full-time at a factory, she deserves to be remembered for that.
And they were going to some really well-established football grounds as well, Gail. I think that's right. I mean, I just noted a few coming into this, and it was some really big grounds, you know, Old Trafford, Celtic Park, the racecourse at Wrexham, one of the oldest football grounds still in existence, Meadow Lane, Bloomfield Road. There were some fantastic grounds that these girls were playing football at.
Yeah, they played on all the top stadiums at some point or another. So, yeah, and everybody was, you know, was thrilled to see them. The charities knew that if the Dick Curl ladies were in town, they would get a good crowd. They had to refuse over 50 or 60 invitations during 1921 because they just couldn't fit them all in.
You mentioned it earlier, one of the kind of the reasons and the drivers of the team's formation and these games was the money they were raising for charity. And they raise a crazy amount of money, really, don't they?
Yeah, throughout the history, it's estimated that they raised over £180,000. But in today's terms, we'll be looking at a figure in excess of £10 million.
Wow.
They deserve a bit of credit for that, too. You can imagine all that suffering that they helped to ease.
Yeah, no, it's an extraordinary achievement. Now, everyone seems to be enjoying the development of Dick Curl ladies and women's football in general, and it's riding a crest of a wave, and we're getting these incredible attendances. But obviously not everyone is enjoying it, because then the FA come up with a pretty draconian reaction, don't they?
They did, yeah. do, they do. They made it increasingly difficult throughout 1921, to be honest with you, for them to play football, because there'd been rumblings, you know, from lots of different quarters. And so they were asking the clubs that they couldn't just let the women play. They had to get the sanction from the FA, so they had to ask permission. And then they also had to send a statement of accounts for where the monies went after the game. So it got increasingly more difficult throughout 1921. But then, of course, on the 5th of December 1921, the FA banned ladies' football and, you know, changed the course of the game forever, really.
Did they have a rationale or a defence, or what reasons did they give?
They said they'd had complaints regarding women playing football, and their opinion was the game of football was quite unsuitable for females and should not be encouraged. And they were also suggesting that not enough of the monies raised at the matches was going to charitable causes. Too much, they said, was being absorbed in expenses, and it's for those reasons that they banned women from using league grounds.
Obviously, one of the suggestions is that it coincided. They were obviously getting higher attendances than many of the men's football at the time. And also, the FA was looking to expand the Football League at that stage as well.
Yeah, well, they'd expanded the league, and it had practically doubled in size. So there was a new division between North and South to populate. And there were still thousands and thousands of people going to watch women's football, and in some cases, you know, a great deal more than the third division sides. And I don't think you have to be a brain surgeon to work it all out, really, do you?
No, I think we can see there might have been some self-interest going on there.
Yeah.
So obviously the immediate effect for Ditka ladies is that they can't play on sort of, is it any FA league ground or is it any FA affiliated ground?
Anything to do with the FA they weren't allowed to play on. But they had their own pitch to play on. The company had bought Ashton Park at the end of 1919, and the Ditka men's team used to play there as well. But the first game after the ban, I think that was played on Boxing Day 1921. They played Fleetwood Ladies, and they had that facility to use. But then rugby grounds opened the doors as well. And any ground that wasn't affiliated to the FA in any way, that they had no jurisdiction over, they could play on those kind of grounds. And they'd just play anywhere.
And were the crowds still coming to watch?
Yeah, yeah. Even though the ladies I spoke to who played up to the Second World War and after, they were still talking about 5,000 crowd at the games and stuff like that. And, you know, that was it pretty much, you know, throughout the history. That's what got me into this. When I organised the reunion, seeing that first picture of them playing in the 1950s and the amount of people on the touchline, but nobody came to watch us. I just couldn't believe it, you know, and it just blew me away. And I just thought, hey, yep, there's a big story here. You know, the next lady I went to see showed me some newspaper clippings from 1946, and they had a full page spread. And I just thought, somebody's got to do something, otherwise this is going to be lost. That was like over 30 years ago now, and I'm still telling the tale, as it were.
Certainly one of the kind of immediate highlights in 1922 is the tour to the US. But even that is far from straightforward, is it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, the FA didn't want them to go. They tried to stop them going, but they did set off, and they arrived in Quebec initially in September of 1922. But then they just got off the boat, and they were told that the Dominion Football Association wouldn't allow them to play in Canada, and that they'd have to go and play against men's teams in the United States. Well, they had no option but to agree, you know, so the girls between them, they just decided to regard it as an experiment, and they went into, you know, America and played 9 games against men's teams.
This team is just unfazed by anything put in its path, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, they just, the tenacity and fighting spirit and just, you know, for the love of the game. They have that. I think that's why I identify with them so much, because I'm a footballer, you know, and you get it when you're part of a team and you've got that love and that commitment in your heart, then there's nothing you won't do.
And they hold their own in the US, actually, against the male teams as well, don't they?
They did all right. They played 9 games. They won 2, they drew 3 and lost 4. but you know, they did well. They held their head high, and the newspapers said that they'd done really well. Showed great spirit in the games, and they made a good impression whilst they were out there.
It just shows this almost unreal existence some of the players were having, that they should be, you know, I mean, traveling to America in 1922 is, I mean, it would take you some time to get there apart from anything else.
Yeah, you know, they took it in the stride, you know, I mean, obviously they'll have been thrilled with the adventure of crossing the Atlantic and going to play football, but they took it in the stride, and when they stopped playing, they didn't talk about it anymore, you know. It was just, that's it. No, they didn't, I suppose they didn't think anybody was interested or whatever. But yeah, they didn't really talk about it. It's surprising how many, when I was doing my initial research and trying to talk to people, that the parents or their grandparents, they didn't talk about it. And yet when I met Alice Norris, she was chuffed to bits that a book was being written about her football team. Mm. You know, she absolutely loved it. And she said to me, I'd be proud to be a Dick Kerr's girl. It'd be worth all the effort we put in. You know, and I met these people. It's just amazing. I'm just so blessed.
One of the players we haven't talked about, and I feel we should. I think when she came to Dick Kerr, she was just 15 years old. I think she'd been spotted at St. Helens when she was 14 years old, and that's Lily Parr. What type of player was Lily?
Yeah, she was 15 when she came to play for the Dick Kerr Ladies. Just 15. She was a great player, great left foot, very, very powerful shot. Lots of people have sort of intimated that she was a bit lazy, you know, didn't do it probably with a shot like that. You didn't need to. But she's not what she's been made out to be. You know, she was a very shy lass, very, very shy, bit of an inferiority complex, wouldn't talk in a room full of people, you know, anything like that. But on the pitch, she was obviously a great player, but she had a fantastic sense of humour. Everybody talked about her one-liners. You know, they said she had them in fits of laughter. And it's lovely to hear that. And her work ethic, what a kind, gentle human being she was. It upsets me, really, what she's been made into just to fit somebody's agenda. But you won't see any of that on Wikipedia. You'll only see what the agenda is. So in my own little way, I'm trying to put it right when everybody asks me about her, that she was just an ordinary lass who didn't think she was anything special and got on with her life. And she lived in a small rural village, and she was well known because of the fact that she played for the Dick Kerr Ladies and that she was a nurse at the hospital, and she drank in the local pub. But she just lived an ordinary life and didn't think she was anything special at all. And I know a lot about Lily because of Joan Worley, a great friend of hers, and she really looked up to her. And Joan grew up playing football with Tom Finney. You know, and that's another story.
Share away.
Well, I've got John and Tom, I can tell you about them, yeah, but you wanted to talk about Lily, so we'll talk about them now. But yeah, she did break a man's arm. It's a true story, playing football. It was in 1924 in Ashton Park, and Franklin had written a letter to the press about her, saying, and the headline was Champion Girl Footballer. And he'd said in it that she was, what a great player. She could kick a ball on a football pitch as good as any of our star players. In fact, she has already. Any critics would be welcome to come along to the next match. So sure enough, you can imagine that being like a red rag to the bull.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm told by the girls that were there who told me the story that it was the goalkeeper from Chorley. And he went up to Lily and he said, "You might look good kicking in against other women, but you'd never score a goal past me." Well, you didn't talk to Lily like that. So, you know, she, all right, mate, you get it next and I'll take a penalty against you. We'll see what happens. So he got it next. She put ball off spot, ran up and took a shot, and he put his arms up to try and save it, and power of a shot broke his arm. And that is a true story. I have that from Alice Norris, from Eva Gardner. You know, I do know that it's true. She also cracked a crossbar at a football match in the 30s, I think that was. So yeah, she was a very, very powerful shot. But Joan Worley described her. She said, "She always reminded me of a bit like Chris Waddle. You know how he had a bit of a lumbering gait? He always seemed like he was." Yeah. She said, "Well, probably like that. She had a bit of a lumbering gait." That's what she said. So she didn't really run at anything. Jean Lane said to me that this is like later on in Lily's career, you know, coming to end. She said, She never ran for anything. You know, we'd come off pitch, all sweaty, and Lily had come off just like she'd gone on, you know, and still looking great. And she's like, how do you do it? And Lily had said, I know what they're going to do before they even get the ball. I don't need to run, you know. So that's what she was like. I wish I'd ever been around to meet her. That's another one I'd like to have around for a brew. But yeah, Joan Morley, if you want to talk about Joan. Mm. Joan and Tom played football together when they were kids, and they were always knocking about together. She used to say to him, what do you want to do most, Tom? He said, I want to play Fit North End, Joan. She said, I want to play Fit Dick Kerr Ladies. And they both got the wish, and they both played on the right wing. And arguably, I'll say, they're the best two right wingers this country's ever produced. So, you know, she never saw him after he signed on Fit North End, and she got to play Fit Dick Kerr Ladies until in the 1950s when he was officiating at one of the matches. And it was walking down the line, shaking hands with everybody. And when he got to Joan, she put her hand out. She said, "Hiya, champ." And he said, "Hiya, champ." You know, and it was a lovely moment that they'd not seen each other in all that time. And then she never saw him again until the book launch of the paperback edition way back in 1997, I think, something like that. And I got them together then. And she'd not seen him for like 50 years or more. And not long after that, she passed away. So we just got that in the nick of time. So, and when she died, on the local radio station, they played it, you know, a tribute to her every hour. And Tom was part of that. He was saying, you know, how sorry he was that she'd gone.
I think it probably also speaks to there's such a heritage of football in Preston at that period of time as well, isn't it? It's a really, it's already something that is a thing. You know, and something that people get behind and proud of in that city, isn't it?
Yeah, we had, you know, with Tom Finney, with Tommy Docherty, Bill Shankly played for North End. That's why Liverpool is so good, because he learnt all his skills at Preston, you see. lots of good players came through Preston North End.
So the challenge of, you know, doing the story, researching the story, finding out about these players, I mean, how on earth where do you begin? But also, I mean, how much detail can you get? I mean, I was interested in you saying that, oh, you know, that Chelsea game, I can't get much detail on the game. I mean, how easy is it to tell how the team set up, you know, what positions players are playing, you know, what their skills and attributes were? I mean, how much do you think you know about these players?
Probably more than lots of other folk. I think I was lucky in as much as I came along at the right time. Nobody else had been interested in them for so long. And I got to meet some of the players and some of the family members of the players. Like, I got at Franklin's scrapbook, Kath Latham, who took over after he died, she gave me his scrapbook, which went back to 1917. And it wasn't in chronological order, but, you know, you could fathom it out and get lots of stuff from that. And then Joan Morley gave me her scrapbook, and she kept a meticulous record from 1937 to 1952. And Jean Lane, who started playing in 1950, kept a diary record, and I got copies of that. I've also got copies of Alice Bunce's diary, Alice Stanley, as she was known as then. So I had all this in my hand, really, and then nobody else could have done it because it was too big of a task. You know, you couldn't go to all the towns in England or Scotland or where they played. And I had it. I had loads of results, goal scorers, and what people told me about the women. And the longer it's gone on, I've shared my life with them now for over 30 years, the more I've got to know them. Apart from football, they're incredible women. And as I said, I just came along at the right time. But to illustrate to you how nobody knew about them or gave a flying fig about women's football, I went to interview Lily Parr's nephew, and he couldn't tell me anything about her at all. And I thought, well, that's been a bit of a wasted journey, but, you know, nonetheless. Anyway, he gave me a copy of, when she passed away, a eulogy, you know, a death report in the paper. And there was very little in it, you know. It just said, I think it was Stanley Matthews of Women's Football Dies. And then when I was getting up to leave, he said, I've got her old boots at shed. You can have them if you want. You know, so nobody knew. That puts it as it was then. Nobody knew anything. Whatever you know now has come from the stuff that I managed to piece together. But, you know, these boots have been at shed, rotting, for, I don't know, 20 years or more. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think in 1950 she played her last, 51 she played her last match. So this is 30 odd years. Boots rotting in its shed. I've got her old boots, you can have them. That just sort of puts it into perspective how nobody knew anything about the Dick Curl ladies. Other than, you know, they went to America or they played a game and nobody knew what a big story it was. It was just a little thing. There was an odd picture perhaps and people would have thought, oh, they played a game of football. Yeah, so I would look at, I read somebody put on Twitter recently about reading my book and they said about reading about Tom and Joan playing football. They said it in my mind that I could see them together playing. And he said, you were the right person in the right place at the right time. And I think, you know, we're all put on this earth for a reason. And I think that's one of the reasons that I've been sent here was to look after them, because I don't do it to make any money or, you know, it's about getting them the recognition that they deserve, because I'm a footballer and I know how they must have felt.
The recognition has started to come. I mean, it's very belatedly, but it must be rewarding, you know, starting to see the attention, you know, that when you walk past the blue plaque, which is at the old factory, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah. Well,
that must just be fantastic.
It is, you know, because it was me that got it done, and I wanted them to have to be marked in the town where they played and where they lived and you know, were born and grew up, and so that, and then there's the memorial at Preston North End, and you know, all the names are on there. Met this bloke just the other week when I go for a walk every day, and he stopped me. He said, "Are you Gail?" I said, "Yeah, Gail Newsham." I said, "Yeah, Dick Curl ladies." Yeah, he's just lost his mother. He said, "I didn't know that she played football, and my dad's just told me." I said, "What were her name?" He said, "Pat Wilkinson." And I came home and had a look through me stuff, and I've only got one fixture list in 1955, I think it was, and she's mentioned in the team lineup, and her name is on the memorial at Preston North End. And I told him about it because it was his mum's funeral, and I said she played in this game and she played at left back just like myself. And then I saw him again just a couple of days ago. He said, "Thanks for getting back to me, Gail." He said, "Somebody's told me about the memorial at Preston North End and old names." And I said, "Your mum's name's on." He said, "Yeah, no." He said, "Thank you." So, you know, that's what it's about. It's become not just a tribute to them, but the families can come and get comfort and say, "That's my mum or my great auntie or my great grandma or whatever," you know. And
so obviously the ban eventually, but it takes 50 years for the ban to be repealed. 71 is it, I think.
That's the date that everybody's got in their mind, but really it was beginning of 1970. Because Pat Gregory, I don't know if you ever spoke to Pat Gregory, she was one of the founding members. In fact, she's the only surviving founding member of the Women's Football Association. Arthur Hobbs was the guy that they founded it, you know, together. And he had written to the FA about rescinding the ban and invited them to their inaugural meeting when they formed the Women's Football Association in 1969. And nobody showed up, but he didn't let go. And they got a letter at the beginning of 1970 saying that, yes, they'd rescind the ban and that they could use referees and they could get, you know, pitches and stuff like that. It wasn't let's mark this date as the lifting of the ban. It just sort of came up because they'd all formed the Women's Football Association and the FA weren't giving any money or anything, just they saying, yeah, you could have referees and, you know, so they'd rescinded the ban. But 1971 was when UEFA got involved, and then 1972, I think FIFA said you have to do this and you have to do that. But even then, the FA still left the Women's Football Association to their own devices. They recognise them, but they still weren't giving them any money.
You know, quite frustratingly, I guess, is that by the time that happens, Dick Curl ladies have finally stopped playing. They play right through to, is it 1965?
Yeah, 1965. But, you know, it's as I always say, everything has a life, nothing's forever. And we've got this wonderful legacy and this wonderful history that no other town, city, country in the world has.
When women's football in 1970 was recognised, and Gail has alluded to it, I think it's important important to kind of point out, the FA did leave the women's game still on the sidelines. It wasn't really until the mid-1990s that a little bit of funding started to come from the FA. So it's not a quick thing. The FA weren't quick to support the women's game from that period. It was a good 20-odd years before they actually started to fund women's football.
Yeah, 1993, the FA took over. You know, then again, nothing mattered before 1993. You know, for a long time, we've been the forgotten generation. You know, what we did, nobody gives us tuppence for, you know. But, you know, thankfully, I think the FA, I mean, they've been very supportive of me, you know, Baroness Sue Campbell and Rachel Pav, and they do get it. And I think our memorial to the Dick Kerr ladies with all the names on it, it might have given them a bit of a nudge, because they're starting to recognise women's football more now. And at Wembley last year, when they had the 1972 squad going around Wembley, I mean, wasn't it a joy? Isn't it joyous when we celebrate the history of women's football? And that's just going back to 72. Yeah. Sheila Parker, who was the first captain of the England team, started her career with the Dick Kerr ladies in 1961. So, you know, it's a rich tapestry all woven together.
You know, it is great to see the women's game as healthy and strong. It must be extra frustrating for you, because you were playing, you know, during this period where there was no light shined on it. But
nobody cared, but we cared. And that's, you know, we cared for this. I cared for the team. I organised an international women's football tournament. I was treasurer for the club. I was a league management committee member. Football was my life. If I wasn't going to meetings, I was training or I was playing. To me now, it's wonderful, because I feel I'm in a privileged position, really, because I'm so close to the Dick Kerr ladies and that, you know, and knowing the whole story, and then the Women's Football Association, and then my own experience playing, and now seeing us come out the other end. It's just wonderful. The script was written on the 6th of December 1921, the day after the ban, the women's football, we would win the Euros. I knew we were going to win the Euros before we even kicked a ball.
If you'd been managing that England side in the final itself, and you could have snuck one or two players from the historic Dick Kerr ladies side, is there anyone you'd have looked to get squeezed into the team?
Well, yeah, I was talking to them, you know, before. I said, now look, we're going into the final this game, it's Germany. Right, so it's important. So if you're around, I had Ellis Kell at the back, because she was a fantastic defender. She, in the mould of Bobby Moore, she was cracking player, but could also score goals. So I had Ellis Kell at the back, and Jessie Wormsley in midfield. She was a she played on the left. She played on the left in Jessie, so she was midfield. And then I had Flo Redford and Jenny Harris up front. So I knew they would have definitely been in. Well, they were there. And, you know, I'm sure they would have been, all of them would have been in the stands clapping and cheering along with the rest of them. I think Kerr Heaven would have been rocking that night, I'll tell you.
So, yes, we come to our ranking of these teams. We try to give them their place in history, and we have five categories. The highest is the all-time greats, true greats, touch of greatness, edge of greatness, and a blink of greatness. We won't be needing any of the ones down there. Jamie, maybe I'll start with you. How would you rank this team and its legacy?
Well, first I'll start with a confession. I already had felt for some period of time this is one of the most important and greatest teams that English football has produced, and what Gail has done and continues to do is shine a light on this incredibly important football team. And I have nothing but admiration and respect for what you're doing, Gail. I think it's a fantastic dedication of time, and I hope the world get to learn all about this particular team. Nothing we talked about has diminished my view. In essence, it's gone up even more. For me, Dick Kerr ladies, and we're talking about the period of 20 to 22, but we're talking about the whole of the team, to be honest. They are an all-time great. They are the original Lionesses. The stuff that they've done, not just on the field, but the money that they've raised off the field, the equivalent of £10 million raised, is incredible. And that alone is a story worth telling, let alone the ridiculous number of games they played in 1921. And I think, Gail, they won almost all of those games as well in the process. Did I read that right?
In 1921, yeah, they won all 67 games.
I mean, do we need to say more on where we rank them? Dick Kerr, ladies, all-time greats.
Definitely.
Well, yeah, they are one of, well, probably the all-time great, really. I went in 2019, we went to the Northwest Football Awards, and they gave us a special recognition award to mark the end of the centenary of the First World War. And they described him as probably the most important team in the history of women's football. And that they are. And it's not just football. It transcends to so many different, you know, aspects of their lives, yeah, and everything. So for me, I mean, obviously, they're the number one.
And you're going to get no arguments. No arguments from me. There's no question. Dick ladies, all-time greats, without doubt.
I tell you what, Gail, Graham, I was just going to kind of share, that's a badge of honour, because Graham likes to play devil's advocate and try to talk things in a different direction. Just because, and the fact that he's just falling over just straight away on that one is an absolute badge of honour.
The only thing I was going to pull up, but I could, even this was difficult, because they weren't in organised leagues or cups, you know, they don't have silverware to show for anything. There would be, it would be harsh to pull them up on the grounds of this, but there was some debate around, because they used the title, didn't they, world champions? And that did seem to be a...
They called themselves world champ because they'd beaten everybody. They went to a run of over 200 games without defeat from the 1920s to 1934. You know, you can't argue with that. But in 1937, because they called themselves world champions, they had it on their headed note paper. And although it wasn't an official thing, they felt justified that they'd beaten people from, you know, all over the world. Edinburgh ladies had seen the note paper, and they objected to them calling themselves world champions, and they them the best team in Scotland. So they accepted the challenge, and the press documented it. There's loads of press cuttings, you know, a championship of the world match and all this. They played the game, and the Dick Kerr ladies won 5-1. So, yeah, they I think they're justified in claiming that they were world champions. Who else has gone over 200 games without defeat?
It is difficult to argue with. It is difficult to argue with. The other thing we always like to do is we always like to think of, and there's no danger of this because we haven't invented a time machine yet. But if we do, we will be back in touch and we'll give you the chance to honour this. But if you did have a time machine, if there was one game or one moment in a game that you could watch, Gail, where would you love to go back to?
I think it'd have to be the Goodison match, wouldn't it? I'd like to see that for myself, you know, and feel the atmosphere and the crowd. And so, yeah, I think the Goodison match, definitely. I'd love to be in a time machine watching that.
One and a half time. Who, hang on, they're moving Asgith back up front. No, this will never work. Jamie, where would you go back to?
The game against St Helens at Goodison is also definitely up there. But I think I would probably go back a couple of weeks beforehand and watch the game under the makeshift spotlights. I think that would be quite fascinating to go to a night. I mean, night games under the lights is always an incredible experience when you watch live football. I think to be in 1920 under... And the smell of the petrol, seeing Bob Holmes paint the ball every 5 minutes, I think that would be fascinating. So that very narrowly clips it for me. That's where I think I would go in the time machine. And if I could stick around for, you know, a week or two, I could go to the Goodison game as well.
I did meet a gentleman that was at that match. It was in his 90s when I interviewed him. He said that he thought that the girls were very good at football, and he said the player most outstanding, and after all those years, he remembered the captain's name, Alice Kell. He said she was the player most outstanding, and he'd never forgotten her name in all those years.
I think the investigative journalist inside me, if there was one, would have to go I want to be in the factory yard watching that first ever game and discovering
what the result was.
Did,
yeah.
What the result was. What the result was. That's what I'd want to know. And just seeing it right at the inception of it would just be brilliant. So I think that's where I'd go back to. Although I'm obviously tempted by watching the searchlights, which is definitely great.
Before we kind of wrap up, so that's where we're going, I think it's important to kind of, you know, send our listeners to some very important places. We've referenced it in A League of Their Own. You've recently updated this, as you've already referred to. I know for definite you can buy on Amazon because I've bought it on Amazon. You can also go to the dickkerladies.com website, which is a fantastic website. There is incredible memorabilia. There's all of the player names. You can learn so much about Dick Kerr Ladies just going on that website. But I encourage you to go to Amazon or wherever you want to get your books from and buy Gail's book on Dick Kerr Ladies.
Absolutely. And I was going to ask, Gail, if anyone finds themselves in Preston, where can they find the blue plaque?
It's on Strand Road in Preston. It's on the factory wall. It's still there. And it's in an arch, and it's got the years 1900 underneath it, but when that building was built.
Brilliant.
That's fantastic. So definitely worth going to. Gail, it's been a real pleasure having you on. Thank you so much for being our human Wikipedia today. Far better than Wikipedia. Thank you so much for your time.
You've been very kind. It's been lovely to meet you both. Thank you very much indeed.
Excellent. Jamie, thank you as ever.
This has been fantastic, Gail. It's been a privilege to spend an hour and a half with you talking about this football team. Thank you so much for your time. We really do appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thanks very much, guys. Good luck with your podcast.
Thank you. That's it for this week. Please get in touch with any comments about the incredible stories you've heard today and with any suggestions on any great teams we should cover, particularly from the women's game. We do plan to do loads more of them. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please leave a review. Don't forget to subscribe, and we'll see you again next time.